We all kind of know him, right? Michael Kelso from That 70s Show.
Yeah.
You know, the high energy, lovable goofball yelling, burn!
Yeah, that's the image, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The sitcom heartthrob.
But if that's where your mental picture of Christopher Ashton Kutcher, well, stops.
Yeah.
You're really missing the most, I think, fascinating part of his whole story.
Absolutely. When we dive into the sources for this deep dive, and they cover his whole life, really, from Iowa to Silicon Valley, we're not just reading like a standard celebrity bio.
Yeah.
We're actually tracking this really meticulous high-stakes journey, how someone goes from modeling to TV icon to producer, and then, and this is the kicker, a really serious player in venture capital.
And doing activism on the side. Well, not just on the side, major activist.
Right. Running a global anti-trafficking organization, it's a lot.
It's a staggering path. So our mission today is to really map that out, especially trying to figure out how a kid from the Midwest, with a frankly pretty dark and troubled past, how does he manage to build and then leverage the kind of wealth you need to become this, like, financial multi-hyphenate? And here's something we found, kind of the initial aha moment for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
That drive, that initial like rocket fuel for all this ambition, it wasn't really about chasing fame at all.
No, it was rooted deep down in, well, desperation.
Yeah.
And this desire to solve a really personal, really intense medical crisis in his family.
And that's what makes his story, I think, so compelling. It's not just the usual tabloid stuff.
Exactly. It shows this fundamental resilience, this ambition that's totally separate from the typical Hollywood making it narrative.
Right.
You see this origin story driven not by, like, I need to land the next big role, mm-hmm. but by a very pragmatic, almost scientific goal of saving his brother.
Wow.
And that core motivation, you can argue, really informs a lot of his later moves,
mm-hmm.
especially into technology and investment.
Okay, so let's unpack that starting point then. We got to go back to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Christopher Ashton Kutcher, born February 7, 1978.
Yeah, classic Midwestern background in many ways. Raised in what the sources describe as a relatively conservative Catholic family.
Okay.
You know, Czech, German, Irish roots, working class parents. His mom, Diane, worked at Procter & Gamble, P&G, huge company. And his dad, Larry M., was a factory worker.
Solid blue-collar America.
Pretty much. But the thing that really defined his early life, the thing that overshadowed everything, wasn't the town or the job descriptions. It was his family's health crisis.
Right. He has a twin brother, Michael. Fraternal twin.
Exactly. And Michael was born with cerebral palsy.
Hmm.
And even more critically, he developed cardiomyopathy, a heart muscle disease. Needed a heart transplant when they were kids.
God, the stress of that must have been immense.
Unbelievable. And the sources really capture the psychological weight this put on young Ashton. You see the lasting impact.
He's talked about it publicly, hasn't he? Some of the quotes are intense.
They really are. He described this constant fear, saying something like he didn't want to come home and find more bad news about Michael. And his way of coping wasn't, you know, shutting down. It was the opposite. Hyperactivity. He said he kept myself so busy that I didn't allow myself to feel. Just constantly moving, trying to outrun the fear, I guess.
Trying to control something when everything felt out of control.
Exactly. And this stress, this feeling of helplessness,
yeah,
it led to a really, really dark moment. Just shows the depth of his turmoil back then. At 13 years old, he actually considered suicide.
13. That's hard to even imagine knowing the Kelso persona.
It is. He admitted telling his dad he was thinking about jumping off a hospital balcony in Cedar Rapids.
Oh, my God.
And the motivation, this is heartbreaking, was this desperate, completely unscientific idea that maybe his heart could save his brother.
Just desperate love, really.
Totally. His dad found him, stalked him. And then shortly after, the news came. A donor heart was available. Someone else's tragedy became their miracle. But that moment, that intense trauma, it clearly shaped his early ambition, pointed him towards science as like a way to find answers, a way to take control.
Okay, so that sets up the drive for science. But before he even got to college, there was this other big detour, right? A major screw up.
Yeah, the pivot point. He was at Clear Creek Amana High School, senior year. He gets arrested.
Arrested? For what?
Breaking and entering, basically.
Yeah.
Third-degree burglary. He and a cousin broke into the high school at night trying to steal money.
Wow. Teenagers do dumb things, but that's significant.
Big consequences. Got convicted. 3 years probation, 180 hours of community service. But maybe worse, personally. He lost his girlfriend, lost the college scholarships he was counting on. He said he basically became an outcast in his community.
The sources do say he felt it straightened him out. But yeah, suddenly he's off the expected path. And this is where that earlier trauma, that drive, kind of comes back.
Absolutely. That need for a solution, a scientific fix for Michael's condition, it comes roaring back. He enrolls at the University of Iowa in August 96. And what does he major in?
Let me guess. Biochemical engineering.
Bingo. Not drama, not communications. Biochemical engineering. His stated goal, according to the sources, was literally to find a cure for his brother's heart problem.
So it wasn't just, I want to be an engineer. It was, I need to solve this problem.
Precisely. That specific driving motivation. But, you know, college life wasn't all serious study. He apparently had a pretty wild side, too.
Oh, yeah.
He later admitted he was wild and noisy, played way too hard, got kicked out of his apartment.
Okay, so a typical college kid in some ways, despite the serious goal, but he had to pay for it, right? Lost those scholarships.
He did. And this is where you see that work ethic, that hustle. How did he earn tuition?
This is the amazing detail. Working at a cereal plant.
Yeah, summer job at the General Mills plant back in Cedar Rapids.
Yeah.
And get this, sometimes selling his blood plasma.
Selling plasma to pay for a biochemical engineering degree? That is dedication.
It really is. Turning your own body into tuition money to pursue this scientific dream. It's the complete opposite of the lazy actor stereotype, isn't it?
Totally. But just as he's grinding, selling plasma, aiming for this very serious degree, pure luck intervenes.
Total chance encounter. He's just hanging out, having a beer at the airliner bar in Iowa City.
Yeah.
A model scout spots him.
Just like that.
Just like that. Leads to him entering this Fresh Faces of Iowa competition. He wins the prize. A trip to the IMTA convention in New York.
The International Modeling and Talent Association.
Right. And boom, next thing you know, he's got a modeling contract. He's heading to LA to try acting. The whole biochemical engineering plan. Sidetracked by a beer and a lucky break.
It's one of those classic Hollywood discovery stories, but rooted in something so much grittier. Selling plasma one minute, modeling the next.
An absolutely wild turn of events. And once he made that pivot to entertainment, things moved incredibly fast.
So 1998, after that IMTA thing, he signs with Next Modeling Agency.
Yeah, a top agency. Suddenly he's doing campaigns in Paris, Milan, Calvin Klein commercials. I mean, that's hitting the ground running.
And then, almost instantly, the TV role that just defined him for years. Michael Kelso, that 70s show starting in 98.
Right. He was on that show solid until 2006. Although, you know, the sources say he started pulling back a bit in that last season, season 8.
Because other things were already starting to happen. Film, producing.
Exactly. His film career took off pretty quickly alongside the show. He really nailed that early 2000s comedy vibe. Dude, Where's My Car in 2000?
Classic in its own way. Box office hit.
Definitely. And Just Married in 2003, Guess Who in 2005. Lots of successful comedies. But even then, you saw him trying to stretch a bit.
Yeah, he didn't just stick to the goofy stuff. There was that 2004 sci-fi movie, The Butterfly Effect.
Right. That was a significant movie. It wasn't a comedy at all. Dark, kind of a thriller about time travel messing things up.
Critics weren't universally kind, I remember.
No, reviews were mixed. But here's the thing. It was a box office success. Made over $96 million worldwide on a pretty small budget.
Okay, so financially it worked.
It worked. And it sent a signal, right, to Hollywood, maybe to future investors too, that he wasn't just Kelso. He was willing to take risks, leverage his fame for different kinds of projects.
And that sort of strategic thinking, that hedging, it leads right into his next big move, doesn't it? Becoming a producer. While that 70s show was still huge.
Yes. 2003, he creates and hosts Punk'd for MTV. Massive hit. Hidden camera, pranking celebrities.
Everyone watched Punk'd.
Everyone. And this wasn't just him starring in something. This was his creation. It was the launch pad for his production company, Catalyst Films. He ran that with his partner, Jason Goldberg.
And the motivation behind that, was it just creative energy or something else?
Well, the sources point to something more calculated. He apparently realized, look, a sitcom schedule, even a hit one, isn't full-time work. Maybe 30 hours a week on set.
Leaves a lot of downtime. And cash, presumably.
Exactly. Lots of free time, lots of disposable income from the show. So was it purely passion? Maybe partly. But he also described himself as a trier, someone who always needed backup contingency plans.
Ah, okay. Like, the acting thing is great, but what if it dries up?
Precisely. Very pragmatic. Ties back to that Iowa sensibility, maybe. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. If acting goes away, he wanted an infrastructure, a business already humming along. Catalyst was that business.
And it wasn't just Punk'd, right? Catalyst did other stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. He really stacked up the executive producer credits through Catalyst. Mostly reality and unscripted shows. Beauty and the Geek.
Right, I remember that one.
Adventures in Hollywood. The Real Wedding Crashers. Even a game show called Opportunity Knocks. He wasn't just waiting by the phone for acting jobs. He was creating the content, controlling the IP, building a real production business.
Smart move. That infrastructure, that business sense, it must have set him up perfectly for the next massive step. Replacing Charlie Sheen on 2 and a Half Men, that was huge news.
Huge. May 2011, one of the biggest TV casting shakeups ever. Critcher comes in as Walden Schmidt. And the money. Wow.
Yeah. Talk about the contract. What were the numbers floating around?
Widely reported figures were close to $20 million just for the first year.
$20 million in 1 year. That's serious capital generation right there.
Absolutely game-changing money. And it wasn't a flash in the pan. The audience showed up. His first episode, Nice to Meet You, Walden Schmidt. 28.7 million viewers.
Get out! More than Sheen ever got.
Yeah, it set a record for the show's highest viewership ever at that point. So the network's gamble paid off immediately, and he kept earning bank. Reports say he was making $750,000 per episode.
$750,000 an episode.
For his whole run, basically, from 2011 to 2015, that kind of money, sustained over years, that's the financial foundation for everything that comes next in the venture capital world.
Makes sense. You need capital to invest capital. After 2 and a Half Men, he didn't just disappear, though. Kept acting.
Right. He took on the role of Steve Jobs in the 2013 movie Jobs.
Mixed reviews for that one, too, I think.
Yeah, the film itself got mixed reactions, but it was another high-profile, serious role. Showed ambition. Then he did the Netflix sitcom The Ranch for 4 years, 2016 to 2020.
With Danny Masterson, his old co-star, which we'll get to later, unfortunately.
Yes, that connection becomes significant later. And, you know, bringing it full circle, he even popped up as Kelso again briefly in the sequel show, that 90s show, in 2023.
Kind of acknowledging his roots while still moving forward.
Exactly. Maintaining visibility across broadcast, film, streaming, keeping the brand alive.
Okay, so this brings us to the real core of this deep dive, I think. The pivot that really sets Kutcher apart from almost any other actor out there, the move into venture capital.
Yeah, this is where the story gets truly unique. He wasn't just, you know, endorsing a tech product here and there. He actively used his fame, his network, and that 2 and a Half Men money as leverage to get into serious investing.
It started with A-grade investments, right, around 2010.
That's right, he co-founded it, and not with other actors, notably. With Guy Osuri, Madonna's manager, major music exec, and Ron Burkle, the billionaire investor.
Heavy hitters.
Definitely. They brought in Chris Hollett as a fund manager, too. And they started relatively small, at least by VC standards. Put in about $30 million of their own money initially.
$30 million is still a lot of money for most people. But yeah, in VC terms, maybe more like angel investing stage, using their own cash and connections.
That's a good way to put it. A-grade's early value proposition was absolutely about access. Kutcher's celebrity could get them meetings that other small funds couldn't. Startups wanted that connection, that potential platform.
And did it work? Did they pick winners?
Oh, did they ever?
Yeah.
A-grade got it some legendary deals early on. Think Uber, Airbnb, Spotify.
Wow. Okay, so not just small bets. Those are huge.
Huge. And the growth was phenomenal. By 2016, Forbes estimated A-grade's portfolio value was around $236
million. From $30 million to $236 million in about 6 years. That's incredible performance.
It really is. Now, you have to ask, like you said, how much is real cash versus paper value tied up in shares?
Right. Tech valuations can be volatile.
True. The sources don't break down that liquid paper ratio for A-grade specifically. But what they emphasize is that the success of those picks spotting Uber and Airbnb so early proved Kutcher and his partners had real skill in due diligence and spotting trends. It wasn't just luck or fame.
It proved he could manage capital effectively, not just be the famous face on the letterhead.
Exactly. And that proven track record is what allowed the next absolutely critical step in 2015, launching Sound Ventures.
Okay, what was different about Sound Ventures? Why was that such a leap?
This is the key distinction. A-grade used their own money, mostly. Sound Ventures, announced at South by Southwest in 2015, was set up to manage a fund backed by institutional funding.
Institutional funding. So for listeners, what does that mean? We're talking big money, right? Like pensions, endowments.
Precisely. University endowments, big pension funds, corporate venture arms. These are sophisticated investors with incredibly strict rules. They do massive due diligence. They don't just hand over money because someone was on TV.
They need to see proven returns, risk management, fiduciary responsibility, all that serious financial stuff.
All of it. getting institutional backing for Sound Ventures. That was Kutcher graduating. That was a moment he transitioned from being a celebrity angel investor to being recognized as a legitimate, serious fund manager in the financial world.
And Sound Ventures continued the trend of picking diverse and successful companies.
Absolutely. The portfolio is broad. The sources mention investments by 2017 in companies like Neighbourly, ZenReach, ResearchGate.
Duolingo, the language app.
Yep, Duolingo. Kupari Beauty, the insurance tech company Lemonade.
Yeah.
It shows a really wide-ranging investment strategy. Tech, education, consumer goods, fintech.
It's impressive. And thinking back to his original motivation, that biochemical engineering dream, did that science interest ever pop up again in his investments?
It totally did. This is the amazing full circle moment. In 2021, Sound Ventures invested in a company called MeTech.
MeTech, what do they do?
They're an Israeli startup developing cultivated meat using 3D printing technology.
Lab-grown meat, basically.
Yeah, highly complex bioengineering stuff. Investing in that. It feels like a direct echo of that kid in Iowa wanting to use science to solve big problems. He's still betting on fundamental scientific breakthroughs, just in a completely different field now.
That's fascinating. Now, besides the big VC firms, he also dabbled in other kinds of business, right? Corporate roles, restaurants. How do those go?
Mixed results, really. On the corporate side, Lenovo hired him in 2013 as a product engineer.
Product engineer, seriously? Or was that more of a marketing title?
He was presented as a genuine role, combining his tech interest and celebrity profile for product input. How deep it went is maybe debatable. Before that, back in 2007, he was creative director for Ooma.
Ooma, that was voice over IP, right? Like early internet phone calls.
Exactly. VoIP, he made some viral videos for them, used his brand. But Ooma changed their marketing strategy in 2008, brought in a new CMO, and he was out. So maybe the creative director thing didn't quite stick long term.
Any other ventures?
He tried an interactive media arm of Catalyst with Jason Goldberg called Catalyst Media.
Hmm.
They launched an animated thing called Blog Girls. Didn't really take off.
Mm-hmm. And restaurants. That's always tough business.
Very tough. He co-owned an Italian place, Dolce, with Danny Masterson and Wilmer Valderrama from That 70s Show.
Okay. Keeping it in the family, sort of.
And he backed a Japanese place, Geisha House. That one went under in 2013. Restaurants are notoriously high risk, high overhead.
True. Did he get back into retail later?
He did. But maybe learning from those experiences. In 2019, he invested alongside Mark Cuban and others in Veldskoen shoes.
Veldskoen, those South African leather shoes?
That's them. They took a 50% stake in the U.S. business. It's a physical product, durable goods, feels maybe more aligned with consumer branding, less volatile than trendy L.A. restaurants.
Interesting. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Alongside all this business activity, he's also been heavily involved in activism and nonprofit work, and that's where things get complicated sometimes. Thorn is the big one, right?
Thorn is huge. Originally called the DNA Foundation. He co-founded it with Demi Moore, his wife at the time, back in 2009.
And its mission is fighting child exploitation.
Specifically, using technology to combat child sexual exploitation and the spread of child abuse material online, globally. It's a really innovative approach, applying Silicon Valley thinking, data, software, algorithms, to a massive humanitarian crisis.
Sounds incredibly important. But even Thorn faced controversy, didn't it? Something about statistics.
Yeah, there was a significant dust-up. Kutcher, in promoting Thorn's work, used some very high-end estimates for the number of American children sold into sexual slavery, figures like 100,000 to 300,000.
Okay.
The Village Voice newspaper pushed back hard, publishing analysis suggesting the real number, while still horrific, was likely much lower, probably in the hundreds based on verifiable cases.
So a dispute over the scale of the problem. How did Kutcher respond to that criticism?
Aggressively. He went on Twitter, where he was already a massive presence. Remember, he was the first user to hit 1 million followers.
Right. Beat CNN in that race.
Exactly. He used that platform to basically call on Village Voice advertisers to pull their funding from the paper.
Wow. Trying to defund them.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
He argued the paper was hindering the fight against exploitation by questioning the high numbers he felt were needed to spur action. It showed he wasn't afraid to use his media power quite forcefully to defend his organization and silence critics.
That intense media savviness also connects to his own digital platform, A+, doesn't it?
It does. He first launched a Twitter client called A+ in 2011. Then, in 2014, it evolved into A+, the media company.
What was the focus of A+?
It was all about positive, upbeat stories, uplifting content, basically, socially driven. Kutcher was chairman. And he got significant traffic reports mentioned, like 27.5 million unique visitors a month in the U.S. Another example of him translating celebrity reach into a functional media business.
Okay, but that media savvy didn't prevent some major public relations disasters. We have to talk about the PopChips ad scandal in 2012.
Oh, yeah. That was bad.
Yeah.
A real train wreck.
Yeah.
It demonstrates a pretty shocking lack of judgment, frankly, from everyone involved.
Remind us what happened.
PopChips ran this ad campaign where Kutcher portrayed several different characters. One of them was an Indian man named Raj, who was supposedly looking for love.
And the problem was?
The problem was it involved Kutcher wearing brown face makeup and using this really exaggerated, stereotypical Indian accent.
It was
cringeworthy and offensive.
Yikes. How was the reaction?
Immediate and brutal.
Yeah.
Online viewers, the Indian American community, yeah. Just widespread condemnation, cultural appropriation, racist stereotyping, the whole nine yards.
So he had to pull the ad?
Instantly. Damage control mode. It was a huge unforced error and probably a big learning moment for him about the responsibilities and potential pitfalls of celebrity endorsements, especially crossing cultural lines for cheap laughs.
Definitely showed the limits of that goofy Kelso humor. Now, his investments and personal beliefs have also drawn him into some pretty complex geopolitical territory, especially around Israel.
That's a really consistent thread. He practices Kabbalah, which is a form of Jewish mysticism. He's visited Israel multiple times, studied Torah there. He's called Israel near and dear to my heart, even the source of creation.
Okay, so a strong personal connection. How did that intersect with his business?
Remember, he was an early prominent investor in Airbnb.
Right.
That connection put him right in the spotlight of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2016, he was actually confronted by a protester on stage at an Airbnb event.
Why? What was the issue?
The protester was slamming Airbnb for allowing listings by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank, which is obviously a hugely contentious issue under international law. So Kutcher's investment choice directly linked him to that controversy.
And his involvement wasn't just financial, right? He attended events supporting the Israeli military.
Yes. In 2018, he attended the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, the FIDF Gala, in Los Angeles. That event raised something like $60 million for Israeli soldiers and their families. So yeah, he's taken a very public, very supportive stance regarding Israel.
Interesting. But then on the flip side, he's also used his platform for very different kinds of international aid, like the situation in Ukraine.
Absolutely. And that was deeply personal, too, because his wife, Mila Kunis, was born in Ukraine.
Right.
So in 2022, after the Russian invasion, they launched a GoFundMe campaign to help Ukrainian refugees. They pledged to match donations personally.
And the response was huge, wasn't it?
Phenomenal. As of March 2022, they'd raised over $34 million. The funds went to support organizations like Flexport for Logistics and Airbnb for Housing Assistance, mainly helping refugees who'd fled to Poland and Romania. It really showed the incredible positive power their combined celebrity and wealth could mobilize for humanitarian cause.
It's such a complex picture, isn't it? Activism, investment, controversy, all tangled together. Let's shift to his personal life again. There's that really traumatic connection to a crime. He was a witness in a murder trial.
Yeah, this is a truly harrowing piece of his life story, something most people probably don't know. Back in 2019, he testified in the trial for the murder of Ashley Ellern.
Who was she?
She was someone he was dating back in February 2001. She was murdered in her Hollywood home.
And he found her? Or?
No, but he was supposed to pick her up for a date that night.
Right.
Arrived late, knocked on her door, looked in the window, saw what he thought was red wine spilled on the carpet. She didn't answer.
Oh, God.
He just figured she was mad he was late and they'd blown him off. He left. He found out the next day she'd been killed. He was never a suspect, but his testimony was crucial at the trial of the man eventually convicted, Michael Gargiulo.
The Hollywood Ripper serial killer.
That's him. Kutcher's testimony helped establish the timeline, basically proving Ellern was likely already dead when he arrived. Gargiulo got the death penalty in 2021. Just an unimaginably traumatic thing to be connected to.
Absolutely awful. Okay, moving to less grim aspects of his personal life. Relationships have always been high profile for him.
Very much so. He dated Brittany Murphy, his co-star from Just Married, back in 2002. Then the huge one, his marriage to Demi Moore in 2005. Big age gap, huge media attention, the divorce in 2013.
And then he reconnected with Mila Kunis.
Yeah, his old, that 70s show co-star, they started dating in 2012, got married in 2015.
And they have kids now, right?
Two kids. A daughter, Wyatt Isabel, born 2014, and a son, Dimitri Portwood, born 2016. And their home life seems to reflect some of his other interests. They live in this sustainable farmhouse they designed in Beverly Hills. Very eco-conscious, apparently.
Interesting. What about his broader worldview? Politics? Beliefs?
He described himself back in 2009 in an interesting way. A fiscal conservative, but a social liberal.
You hear that sometimes from the tech world, that kind of libertarian-ish mix?
Kind of fits that mold, yeah. And on specific issues, like guns, he's spoken out despite being a hunter and gun owner himself. After the Las Vegas mass shooting in 2017, he was very clear, saying things like, nobody needs assault rifles, advocating for stricter laws.
And spiritually. Still follows Kabbalah.
Seems so. Well, the sources say he taught Mila Kunis about it too, and he finds it inspiring, both spiritually and artistically.
Okay. The last couple of years have brought some really major personal challenges into the public eye for him, though. First, that health scare he revealed in 2022.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking. He revealed he'd been diagnosed 2 years earlier with a really rare, serious autoimmune disease called vasculitis.
Vasculitis. That's inflammation of the blood vessels, right? Can be very dangerous.
Extremely. He said it completely knocked out his vision, his hearing, and his balance, his equilibrium, for about a year.
A whole year. Wow.
Yeah, he talked about the terror of not knowing if he'd ever see again, hear again, walk properly again. Said he felt lucky to be alive. It really puts his more recent work and activities into perspective, knowing he was recovering from something so debilitating.
Absolutely. And then, more recently, the huge public backlash surrounding his support for Danny Masterson. This became a massive crisis for him, didn't it?
Immense fallout, yeah. So Danny Masterson, his longtime co-star from both That 70s Show and The Ranch, was convicted on 2 counts of forcible rape.
Right. Decades-old crimes.
Yes. And after the conviction, but before sentencing, both Kutcher and Mila Kunis wrote letters to the judge, character reference letters, basically.
Supporting Masterson, what did they say?
They wrote about him being, in their experience, a good person, a role model, someone who treated people with decency, equality, and generosity. Focused on his character as they knew him personally and professionally over many years.
But sending letters supporting a convicted rapist? Especially given Kutcher's work with Thorne, the anti-exploitation charity he co-founded, that seems like a huge conflict.
Exactly. The contradiction was glaring and immediate. Here's the public face of a major organization fighting sexual exploitation, privately vouching for the character of someone just found guilty of rape. The public backlash was swift and incredibly harsh.
People were furious.
Understandably.
Yeah.
The criticism was intense. It led Kutcher and Kunis to release an apology video.
How did that go over?
Not well, generally. They tried to explain the letters were just for the judge, part of the legal process, never intended to re-traumatize victims or undermine the justice system. But many people found the apology itself felt off.
How so? What was the criticism?
Terms like performative and insincere were used a lot. Critics felt it focused too much on their intentions rather than the actual impact of their actions, the harm caused by appearing to minimize serious crimes. It felt like they were apologizing for getting caught, not for the judgment itself.
And there were real consequences for Kutcher from this, right?
Yeah.
Professionally?
The damage to his reputation, particularly in relation to his activism, was severe. The pressure mounted, and ultimately, he had to make a choice.
He stepped down from Thorne.
Correct. He resigned as chairman of the board of Thorne, a direct result of the controversy. It was a clear, painful example of how private loyalties, when they clash with a very public humanitarian mission, can force accountability and have significant professional costs.
Wow. Okay, so summing all this up, it's quite a journey. We started talking about the guy yelling burn on a sitcom.
Yeah, Michael Kelso.
And we've ended up deep diving into, systemic health crises, complex family trauma, witnessing murder trials, navigating global investments, geopolitical controversies, and these really profound ethical challenges.
An incredible art.
Ashton Kutcher's career really is this study in duality, isn't it? The kid selling plasma for an engineering degree becomes the $750,000 an episode actor. Then he leverages that fame into becoming a seriously successful venture capitalist and uses that influence for major activist work like Thorne, like the Ukraine fundraiser.
What really stands out, I think, is the intellectual rigor he seems to apply to his celebrity status. It's not just about enjoying the fame.
No, it's a tool. It's a calculated lever. Consistently using fame to generate capital, build networks, direct media reach through Catalyst A+, A-grade sound ventures, and often, directed towards specific goals, sometimes humanitarian, sometimes just good business. You still see that problem-solving mindset we talked about from his Iowa days.
Right.
His life really is a masterclass in adaptation and taking risks and leveraging a brand for financial power. But also, crucially, it shows that those decisions, whether it's supporting Masterson or the Pop Chips ad fiasco, can come with huge public scrutiny and force really difficult sacrifices, like stepping down from Thorne.
So thinking about all this, what does it mean for you, the listener? You've heard how this world where celebrity fame crashes into big money venture capital, it inevitably gets tangled up in really complex, often ethically tricky situations.
Yeah, I mean, look at the examples. Yeah. Supporting Israeli defense forces financially while simultaneously facing protests over an investment in Airbnb's West Bank listings. Running a major anti-exploitation charity while also writing a character reference for a friend convicted of sexual violence.
Yeah.
It's messy. It really is. Which maybe leaves us with a final thought to chew on.
Go for it.
What does the future look like for these high-profile figures, these celebrities who are increasingly trying to use their huge financial power, their media platforms, to influence global policy, investment, activism?
It's a growing trend, for sure.
Right. And how do we, the public, hold them accountable when their private actions, their personal loyalties, seem to contradict the very public image of their global philanthropy or their business ethics?
That line between actor, investor, activist, philanthropist.
Hmm.
It's getting blurrier all the time, isn't it? And the stakes, as we've seen with Kutcher, for getting that balancing act wrong, they seem higher than ever.